Listening Dog Media.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It with Kieran Bracken, the rugby podcast that doesn't take itself too seriously.
Welcome back to Ruck It with me, Kieran Bracken, your host. And this week we're joined by Irish legend and Leicester legend, Jordan Murphy.
Ruck It with Kieran Bracken.
Ah, look at that. Jordan Murphy looks a star. Look at the rock star. Look at you.
Sorry, I'm late. Sorry, I'm late, mate. I'm all right.
Not at all. If you just got out of the shower, you're looking all hot and bothered. Or you just had supper.
Had a shower, just had supper, was shoving food down my gob, just trying to give the wife a hand, get the army to bed.
How many have you got?
We had a little girl last Thursday night, so she's just a week old. Well, she'd be a week old in 40 minutes.
Shut up.
Yeah.
And you look surprisingly good, my man. Jesus.
Well,
I thought of doing a podcast, you must have thought, oh, I've got to talk rugby, I've got to talk shite. Let me just have a break, please.
I love it, mate. You know what I'm like.
How many have you got?
Two little boys. So we've got Rex, who's 5 and a half. He'll be 6 next September. We've got Oscar, who's going to be 3 on the 18th of April. And then we've got Otterley, who was born a week ago. So
Otterley,
yeah.
Otterley. Hang on a sec. Otterley. What's that? What's that from? Otterley, is it?
I believe, I don't know. It's a French name. There's a poem by Robert Louis Stevenson to Otterley. But I only know that because I Googled it.
Who came up with the name then? The missus?
Right, the missus.
Is she French?
No, she's not. She's actually, her father is half German, but they reckon it's the female version of Otto or Otterline. I'd never heard it. And we had some other names. So she was born last Thursday and we had some names and we were kind of going, oh, it's this, it's that. And then she was born and we kind of took one look at her and Annika's like, my wife is Annika. And she was like, nah, it's not that. It's not that.
Oh, really?
So we were kind of stood there, and she had no name for about 2 and 2.5 days.
Yeah.
So at one stage it was right. Well, first try scorer on the weekend, England Ireland. We'll just name her that, and it was obviously Earlsy did a good job, but I didn't think it would suit a girl. So I was going, well, maybe not that.
Oh, brilliant! Amazing.
Yeah, it's different.
Oh mate, I'm loving this. But I did look up, I just looked you up just to see what you. I mean, I'm staggered how many medals you won. I'm very jealous, by the way. But I did notice that your family have chosen very English middle names. So you've got Jordan and Murphy, but then you've got Edward and Andrew. Gee, seriously, mate, like, come on, you got to explain something here. Is your mum English? Your dad English?
No English. I actually did one of those heritage DNA tests recently, and it was like a slap in the face. It almost came back and said, "What are you doing?
Why? What did it say?
I was
Celtic."
Like, 95% Irish, 5% Scandinavian, but the name Murphy, Omeraku is apparently a Viking name. So back in the day, the Vikings came cruising down, and obviously there's a bit of a bit left over from a Viking raider somewhere on the line, I believe.
What do you say? Do you send something off? What do you do? Just give your name.
It's just a swab. It's really
a swab.
Yeah. So you literally you swab yourself. You give your DNA swab and put it in a little package. Send it off to a lab in Texas. This is a while ago. And they obviously come back and they sort of deep break down exactly where your DNA is from, sort of codify it from sort of regions of the world and different.
Jordan, you've got it wrong, right? What happens is you send that off, it goes to somewhere like Edgware in London, and there's a load of blokes going, they look you up and they go, yeah, just give it a bit of Irish, a little bit of this. He won't know. Give us 75 quid.
You know, that's distinctly possible. But the freaky thing was, like any of my relatives who've done it. So I have a brother in the States, and obviously kind of you fill in a little bit of your family tree, and then it pings up, and then they send you emails going, well, you know, you've got a second cousin here, a third cousin here. Kind of the tree just sort of propagate, and it's
no way.
Yeah, no, look, I found it really fascinating, but it didn't really need to do it, to be quite honest. But it was
I'm not sure I want to do it. I don't really want to know. Do you know what I mean?
You'll get 100% Irish.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? My mum's definitely a Viking, so yeah, bloody hell.
You were born in Dublin, weren't you?
I was born in Dublin. Drogheda, where were you born in Dublin? Where were you born?
No, Nace, a little bit south of Drogheda, but I remember when you were playing for England back in the day, sort of. Doing well, everyone's going, well, you know, he's Irish.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if I played shit, everyone went, oh, he's English. He's English, isn't he? But you know what? One of the hardest things for me ever was when I first played for England. Obviously, my first game against Ireland, it was the first time I lost in an England shirt. Played against New Zealand, beat the All Blacks, and then suddenly, a few games later in the Five Nations, then I played against Ireland, got smashed 1994. Gagan scored in the corner, my shorts ripped off. Worst day in an England shirt, longest day of my life. But I just remember coming back to Ireland and seeing, you know, people back in Ireland, and they all just ribbed the shit out of me. And they all started standing up, singing the anthem. And honestly, it was just, you know, the crack you have in Ireland, you proper, know, the banter.
Good natured abuse. I was actually at that game. You know, the schoolboy terrace. You know, you run onto the pitch on the right hand side, there was the schoolboy terrace.
Yes.
Yeah, I was in school. I was a fourth year in school.
What a day. You must have loved that.
Absolutely. Simon Gagan, what a hero. Simon Gagan and Jim Staples, I've made it my mission in life to track them down and to go and have a few pints with them post lockdown.
Oh, wow.
Two blokes that I just thought were absolutely exceptional all the way. And I believe they're floating around in London somewhere. So we've got to track them down. We've got to get Jesus. Them after this.
Peter Clarcy, I remember him when I walked back without any shorts on. They got ripped off in that game. And as I was walking back, he went, there's plenty more where that came from, little Bracken. And I remember before the game, we're all going, come on, we're beating the All Blacks, we can beat Ireland. And I could hear my name in the other change room, kill a little fucker, kill. I mean, and I thought, and I looked around, and all the forwards are like, don't worry, you'll be all right, don't worry. And I could, as we walked down the tunnel, they're all glaring at me, they're all like, oh, you traitor. But the whole game, special attention for me, it was the longest day of my life. You know, in those days, we'll talk a bit later about rugby. In those days, you weren't allowed to take a player off the pitch, right? Mm-hmm. So, literally, they had to watch me suffer for 80 minutes. And if ever I was going to be hauled off, it was that game after 25 minutes. Do you know what I mean? But I saw you're commentating, weren't you? You're commentating. So you had a bit of a change of role. I mean, I always look at players and, you know, you know the sort of players that you think will go into the coaching, go into management. And I always thought you'd go into coaching and management. But I saw you commentating or listened to you commentating, you know, nice inside information about the players and about the game. But just want to get, where are you at the moment? Because I know I'd love to find out what happened at Leicester. So you brought in Borthwick and he's obviously got rid of you, hasn't he? I mean, that's amazing. What a coup.
Pretty much. Nah, look, in fairness, it's strange times, really, really unusual times. And look, when I took over at Leicester a couple of years ago, we were in a tough spot and we had to fight really to stay up probably in my first season. You know, we were in a relegation battle and everyone took great pleasure in that on the back of, I suppose, where we'd been for a very long period of time. So 2013. So people were really enjoying putting the boot in and that added pressure and it was a really, you know, steep learning curve. And then, you know, I kind of knew what needed to be done and we found ourselves in, and obviously sort of bringing Steve in as a head coach was kind of, I was very much part of that decision and I still think Steve's a great coach.
Yeah.
But you just find yourself in really unusual times where, you know, obviously the club was massively hit and all clubs have been massively hit by the pandemic in regards to, you know, not having fans in the stadium.
Yeah.
Really financially. And it doesn't make sense, you know.
No.
I, I, to be quite honest with you, you know, the pressure and the stress of it all was a certainly beginning to tell and beginning to take its toll. And you know, I don't envy those guys and any of those coaches now at the minute, because I think they're all understaffed. Everyone's had to make cuts. Everyone's, you know, really fighting to keep their head above water until we get.
So did you just go? Did you just go to the manager and said, "Look, do you know what? I really enjoyed it, but listen, this is just No,
it wasn't that case at all. Like, I would have stayed. I would have been a lifer. And that's, you know, that's the unusual thing about it, in that, you know, I never would have chosen to have left Leicester. Now, I say that that's a strange thing to say, because eventually I did. I had spoken to them about, you know, potentially the mission that was ahead and rebuilding Leicester Tigers. And, you know, we'd had that conversation, and that was sort of perceived to be not a very easy fix to turn the boat around. That was supposed to be a long-term fix. When Steve came in, obviously the pandemic hit, and we'd laid a lot of people off, and kind of my contract was actually out this summer in June.
Yeah.
So I had kind of said to them, look, after 23 years, I think if I'm not going to be contracted again, because kind of everything got pushed into the long grass with wage reductions and the pandemic. So I was kind of thinking, you know, look, actually I'm out of contract. I haven't really ever taken it to this stage where I'm out in 6 months' time.
Yeah.
I said to him, look, just don't drag me on until March, April, and then tell me I don't have a job in July, because that's going to, you know, obviously stress me. And I think I'm due more than that. And in fairness, Andrea, the CEO, dragged me into to the office on a Sunday morning just before the season started, and just said, look, just due to the relation where we're at financially and the position wise, we're not going to renew your contract as of July. So, you know, you can stay on, and if you want, you can stay on and until June and, you know, finish the season out, and then, you know, make your own way into something else, or you can go now. And I turned around and look, my heart was in it. We were going to be playing Gloucester the following week, I think 6 days later. And I just sort of said, look, I physically wouldn't have been able to stand in the changing room with the guys and kind of go, you know, this is all great. I knew it was there. It was hit me particularly hard, as it would after sort of a 23-year association. It was a tough pill to swallow, but you know, everything, all good things come to an end. So as I said, it was, you know, and look, you know, after a few weeks of being away from the environment, I kind of felt like a different person. I think, you know, for a while I hadn't been enjoying rugby. I love rugby, but it just, the stresses of it, you know, when you're thinking when you're in a relegation battle and you're looking at other games and you're watching every game on the TV and you're watching every game trying to pick up as much as you can. And I just really felt that I was in a pool, just, you know, struggling to keep my head above water. But, you know,
I always felt from the outside looking at your team that, you know, you had quite a few England players who were probably on a lot of money, and then you had someone like Manu Tulangi who doesn't play. You had lots of players on big budgets, and then you've got, I mean, I've seen it. Well, I was there at Southsons when we would buy, like, we'd get Francois and Tim Horan and Philip Seller and Thomas Castagnier and da-da-da, and they'd get injured, right? And then we'd have, like, the rest who were, like, you know, okay rugby players, but then it was just nuts. And because everyone saw us as like the Real Madrid, it was just a nightmare, because everyone was expecting us to win all the time. And it was like, hang on a sec, Tim Horan's played four games, you know. And I looked at your team, and it's kind of like, and every team does it, they'll have the superstars, right, on the lot of money. Then the next level will be probably the most important level, where they could play for their country or they're not getting picked, but they're not on a massive wage and they love the club and they're there. And then you've got the young guys coming through, filling the gaps. But you literally had like all of the ones at the top who were England players and massive on big money, either not playing well or injured, right? So then everything, and then you try and fill the gaps all the time. And every time you tried to fill a gap, it was like, then he'd get injured or even play well. And it was just like, how do you do it?
You've hit the nail on the head. The strength of every team that does well in the Premiership is your second team. The guys who you train against, the guy who fill the gaps. And that's always been the way, had always been the way at Leicester. You know, there was always a huge amount of talent there and thereabouts. I think, you know, the salary cap was a huge limiter for that, because, you know, and it changed the game. Professionalism changed the game in relation to that as well, because, you know, guys stayed at Leicester when I came through, you know, for less money because they wanted to be successful. And as you said, it's really unusual, because when you take over as a head coach in rugby union, it's not like football where you can go, actually, I don't like these 10, 15 players. I'm just going to get rid of them and bring in guys that I like. Yeah. The salary cap states that, you know, if you get rid of anyone, you got to pay them out. So that's just a hole in your squad. You can't replace.
Yeah.
So you have
Do you know what? And what's interesting when I look at when you look at, I want to talk about the successes at Leicester that you had, because you know that's much more important than, you know, say you know, the last few years at the, you know, coaching. But I just want to talk about, like, from Saracens, what Saracens realized was they were kind of going, hang on a sec, right? We're paying these international guys who only play a certain amount. We've got these superstars from abroad who are coming on a pension. And they flipped it around. And what they did is said, let's just get all the best young players, right? And then they got some quite good Premiership players. And they only had one or two superstars, right? Not eight, one or two. And then suddenly they did average. And then suddenly the young players started becoming superstars on long-term contracts. And then suddenly they all started, like, okay, let's not talk about the wage gap.
Come on, KB. We know that's not the truth. Okay, we know the reality of it.
There might have been £1 million over, but listen, the story sounds better the way I tell it.
For how many years, KB? That's the question.
That
was just your wages, mate.
Oh, God, I wish.
That was just you taking it over. Funny. I love that. I love the old. You know, Lance Armstrong probably only cheated in his last year.
Oh, come on, my God. I can't believe you just said that.
Leave him at the titles. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your titles. I mean, I'd love to know which one was your favourite, because you've got so many. I mean, the only thing I've got to show in my career, we won the Tetley Bitter Cup in 97, right. I think it was. No, but from your point of view, that we all looked very jealously at the Leicester players. You know, you had a group of players that it just worked, it just clicked. It was just an amazing period. But yeah, just talk about those times from your point of view, because you had so much success, so many medals, so many trophies. It was a special moment of your life, wasn't it?
Yeah. Look, I think I was really, really lucky. And you know, you talked about the winning, and I think winning is easy. I always say that to people. Winning is actually really, really easy. When you're in a big team and you're winning, it's you know, you just go out, you expect to win, you turn up, you churn through the victories, and it's great. The toughest and the best ways to learn are from your disappointments and your losses. Yeah. And you know, I think I was incredibly lucky because of the length of my career at Leicester. I saw it almost, you know, come around a couple of times. And you know, you look at it, and I look at Exeter and Saracens, and they were both saying, you know, Rob Baxter had said to me, and you know, guys, Michael Cole, guys at Saracens have said to me, we looked at the Leicester model, what made Leicester strong through the late 90s into the noughties, and why, you know, you won those four back-to-back Europeans, and tried to take the best things from that. And that's, you know, when you talk about the young players at Saracens and the academy, the guys coming through, that's what it's about. And similarly at Exeter. So it's right. The model that you know, getting the culture right is hugely important. And the model there of having guys who want to be there is massive. You know, I was very lucky. When I joined Leicester, I joined in 1997, came over just on a 3-week trial, and Bob Dwyer was in charge, and he sort of saw something, I guess, in me. I didn't really think I was good enough to be anywhere near the field. You know, I kind of got sent over by a coach. Leicester trained in Limerick that summer, and Eric Miller was over here that time, and Niall Malone, who were Irish internationals. And I went down to watch them train with a coach who had sent me to New Zealand after, you know, when I was in school. And they spoke to Bob Dwyer. He's like, yeah, come over on a 3-week trial. And it was as simple as that. Myself and another one of my best man and my best friend went over with me. And after a couple of games,
Did they get rid of him?
No, he stayed. He stayed for 3 or 4 years. He went back and played for Connacht, and he just had his third hip replacement. He was a 9, same age as me. So yeah, well, most of it's been self-inflicted, to be quite honest. One bicycle accident and a lot of degenerative from all of the twisting and turning you do as a 9. But he was a fantastic player. Just sort of his path was different. He actually there's a YouTube of him burning Bernard Sal, and we played against the Barbarians in about 99 in Twickenham, and he basically turned him inside the old Poe rocket, and he was a 9, but he made him look slow.
Oh, really? Seriously?
Turned him inside out. So when I joined, Leicester had lost the European Cup in 96, and it really had a feel of a rebuild phase. You know, the way everything was going with Bob Dwyer. Bob Dwyer left in early 98, and Bob had sort of played me 10 games in a row, and I was built like a... I think my nickname was Pencil, because I was that thin and small.
Those good old days, my man.
Yeah, the shirts. I look back at the shirts now, and the shirts, when they got wet, I was probably double my body weight. but that season was Newcastle won the league 97, and it was one of those ones where, you know, I knew there was the beginning of something special from the squad that was there, and the body and the talent that were in around the squad. You know, the second a huge amount of international players. You know, guys like Perry Freshwater, who were playing in the second team, who went on to be an England international. But, you know, Pez was just a serious player to, you know, Dorian West in the second team.
Yeah.
Eric Jelly, Dino, John Wells, you know, international quality players in your second team. Noah Malone. Guys who you're sort of playing with on a weekly basis, just going, this is ridiculous. I've come from Naas Rugby Club where, you know, we're trying to contend. Now I'm playing with international players. And you find that the learning curve just accelerates so quickly. The bar.
How did you find it though? Because look, you won so much stuff. That was a golden few years, wasn't it? The Europeans, especially.
What did we win? We won four leagues back to back.
Four league and then the
Europeans back to back until 2003.
Yes.
2003, we after the World Cup. But the thing is it just a different era? Like, you look at the way the team operated in 2003, you won the World Cup.
Yeah.
Martin Johnson came back and he played the following week, 6 days later. I think.
Yeah. So did I in Rotherham. Yeah, horrible.
We played London Irish the following Saturday, and we were down the bottom of the league. We were struggling because we'd had, you know, we'd seven guys with England. We had different guys at the World Cup. And again, you know, we were struggling. We probably had 12 to 14 guys away, first team away. But guys just came back and slotted in and played the week after winning a World Cup final, 6 days after, you know, four days after landing, played against Southern Irish. And we went on a run to get us, I think, to quarterfinals. It was knockouts. Yeah. And I think Bristol beat us.
Yeah.
But that was just what the club was about. It wasn't about, God, you know, I've played international rugby. It's tough. I need a week off.
Yeah. But we'll talk about a bit of captaincy and leadership and stuff. But Jono was, like, when people ask me what he was like, you can't say it, like, there's not enough words to describe how amazing of a person he was and a player he was and a leader. I mean, it must have been amazing for you.
Oh, it was amazing. Like, a lot of people don't know, but when I came to Leicester first, I was picked up in a taxi myself and my buddy, and we were taken to the house that we were going to be staying with because we were on a 3-week trial. And I walked into this house and I was there, you know, kind of walking around the house going, wow, well, you know, I knew Leicester was big. I didn't know enough about Leicester, but I knew obviously Martin Johnson from the Lions in 97. And I knew kind of the guys who played the Lions was big then, you know, living with the Lions. And I was thinking the people who I'm living with, you know, they're really big fans of Martin Johnson. There's pictures of them everywhere. And then obviously it was Martin's parents, Dave Hillary, who I was staying with. So Jonah turned up at the door and was like, you're staying in my bedroom. Don't do anything I wouldn't do. So I slept on the floor for 3 weeks. But, you know, for me, I was really lucky that, you know, I think that he took an interest in my career and kind of kept an eye on me and helped me progress and develop.
Yeah.
So that was really, really good. And it was actually to the extent that when the red carpet incident took place in... Well, look, you know, it was funny because I was getting a lot of people ringing me and they were going, Martin Johnson is a prick. And worse than that.
You were playing in that game? Were you in the game again?
I was playing in that game.
Let's just go back to that moment because everyone thinks that was pre-rehearsed, right? So you were playing the old game where let them go out, let's wait for ages. You ran to the other side of the pitch, right? And you waited there for ages and we lined up for ages going, come on, what's going on? No, this is true. Jordan,
that's
come on.
Bollocks.
No, you ain't, listen.
Total bollock.
You were miles away.
No, what actually happened was, and I know what happened because Jono spoke to me. He said he was in the changing room going, it was after that you'd lost the foot and mouth game too. Was it 03? No, 04, 03, 04?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, 03.
Been around there.
No, it was before that, wasn't it? 02.
No, it might have been 02, but the reality was the last time England had been there was the replayed foot and mouth game where you were expected to win it.
And we lost.
I think Jono in the changing room was saying, listen, these guys, they're going to try and mess us around. We're not taking a backward step. And he was giving it the rhetoric of, we are not. They're going to try and mess with us. We're not.
Yeah.
England walked out and walked to the wrong side of the lineup. It's the same every time.
Okay.
The wrong side of the lineup. We walked out just after you, and kind of there was mass confusion. Like, what's going on here? This isn't right. We're supposed to stand there.
Yeah, so okay.
Everyone's like, look, it doesn't really make a difference. We'll go and stand where we stood. But then, of course, the Irish president comes out, Mary Robinson, absolute saint of a lady, and you know, made everything good that's said about her should be said here now. But she came out, and her protocol was, you know, I walk left. And I come down and I do the visiting team and then I finish with the Irish team on the right. But England had stood on the right, so Jono was there. But I knew, so they sent out an attaché or an aide.
Told him to go.
And he was like, well, look, you know, you're standing in the wrong place. But of course, Jono's in the changing room. He's going, we're not changing. They're not messing with us. They're not taking a backward step. So like, he's built a rod for his own back. He can't move now.
No, he can't move. Like, no.
If after everything he's preached for 10 minutes or 15 minutes in the frenzy to get England up for this game on the back of losing their ass.
Yeah, he's got balls in it. He's got balls of steel.
He's just like, no, we're not moving. And like, I look down. I can remember looking down the tunnel and people are going, what the fuck? What's going on? And I'm going, man, they're not moving. So like,
oh, I love
like,
it.
Jono's not going to move. If he has to stand there on his own, he's going to stand there on his own. And
yeah.
I was like... But he was just in that, his head was like, his head was there. He was in.
And it worked, mate. It worked.
Well, look, we got, it was just before, I think it was before the World Cup in 03. So it would have been 02.
Yeah, we won the Grand Slam. And
You gave us a hell of a beating that.
Yeah,
hell of a beating. But look, it was, to be quite honest, you put us off. That was a dirty tactic. I didn't agree with it. And I still don't.
Oh, listen. But you know, do you know what? Now you're literally on, let's call it gardening leave, holiday. You just had a little baby. Life is amazing. And you're doing commentary. You're going to, listen, you could follow my footsteps, do, you know, dancing on ice or something like that. I don't know, Jordan, but listen, so I want to talk about international rugby at the moment. I don't know how you feel, but I feel the most frustrated supporter. The last thing I want to say to you is, do you think we should get rid of Eddie Jones? But let's just be brutally honest, because you've not got no dog in the fight. Like, do you not think England, their tactics recently have been abysmal? Like, absolutely. Let's just forget about the World Cup final. Sorry, semi-final, that was amazing. Getting to the final is amazing. I know they won the tournament last year, Autumn Nations Cup, they just edged through. But let's just talk about how we're playing and the talent we've really got. He said a couple of weeks ago, England, they haven't got the talent, you know, they're not coming through. And I'm thinking, just look at the Premiership, look at some of these players, just pick some of these players. Like Sam Simmons, you see what he's tearing up. I'm so infuriated. I just want to get, You want him to get another 5 years contract with England. I don't know. But what's your take on how annoyed we all are?
Look, I understand it. I, having been in his shoes, I'm really reticent to ever say anything bad about a coach.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Let's just have standalone his pedigree and how good of a coach he is.
Yeah.
He's one of the best, if not the best coach in the world. Like he's a brilliant, brilliant coach. And, you know, he deserves the credit for that.
How can such a good coach get it so wrong?
You know, I don't necessarily think England have overly changed their tactics. I just think sometimes you go on those dip of form. And I think sometimes teams have a look at it. Now the law changes are something that we should talk about again. That's something that frustrates me, where I see that the game can improve, and particularly the breakdown is my biggest frustration.
I want to talk to you about concussion, but I don't understand where the jackal has just suddenly started over the last 3 or 4 years. The laws have gone mad. I don't know what's going on to our game, but like,
we'll get on to that. But let's go back to Eddie. Like, I don't think the tactics have changed. I actually agree with Eddie. I think, look, okay, so there's some guys that he's not selecting, but you look at the guys that he's going to have to leave out to pick someone like Sam Simmons. Like, Billy Vunipola has been amazing for England. You know, okay, so he didn't he wasn't good at the Six Nations. No. I think he put his own hand up after 2 or 3 games and think he's out of shape. There's a huge knock-on effect from the Saracens guys not playing.
I agree.
I thought that those guys, even Maro Itoje, who was a shoe-in for Lions selection, gave away a lot of penalties. And that's not him. He's exceptional. Exceptional athlete. And, you know, I just thought that those guys, it hurt England, those guys not playing regular rugby. You know, so like, maybe it was a case to bring someone like Sam Simmons in, who has been tearing it up, but his time will come and I'm sure he'll get an opportunity. But I, looking at that England team, I thought there were holes. I didn't think it was as strong as previous English teams gone by. I thought there were holes in certain areas, and I was surprised at some of the selections in the squad. But, I think, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. He's a good coach. I think England are the bad Six Nations. I don't think you throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think, you know, you just roll and see what goes next. And I think he deserves, because of his pedigree, he deserves, you know, to not have to endure the, oh, let's get rid of Eddie chat. You know, if they're terrible in a year's time, then, yeah, let's entertain that.
You must have been happy, though, with the way Ireland played. Because, I mean, I've talked to my brother lives in Ireland and a lot of friends there. And they were getting to stage. They're not really massive fans of Andy Farrell.
Yeah, that breaks me as well. Because Andy Farrell is a good coach. And Andy Farrell, I don't know. He's not a personal friend of mine. I know a couple of the guys in the coaching team. I know Simon Easterby, who was my roommate for a long time. And John Fogarty, the scrum coach, is a very good friend of mine. And I know of Andy, obviously I've had dealings with him and stuff, but like, I thought you know, they lost one game in the Oval and it was, oh, you know, we're not playing great and it's different. And you know, he was taken over on the back of from Joe Schmidt, who had a particular style, but probably was on a dip when he left. Like, Ireland didn't perform at the World Cup just before he left. Now Joe obviously is, again, a fantastic coach. I'm not trying to criticize anyone here, but it was it's always a tough job for Andy Farrell to take over there. And you know, they lost one game in the Oval and people are going, oh, you know, Ireland are terrible. We come to this Six Nations and, you know, the Peter O'Mahony, Peter O'Mahony isn't a dirty player. I know he got two similar red cards in a season, but he's a great player. He's a Lions quality player. And I think, you know, that instant where he gets a red card cost Ireland the game, the reality. Like, Ireland with 14 men still looked like winning that
game. No, they
did.
Billy
misses a touch. And, you know, if he puts that five out in the corner, I'm back in Ireland to get a drive over there. I'm back in Robbie Henshaw to barrel over. And it's a win, and it's a completely different Six Nations for Ireland. You know, they played against a French team that were exceptional on the day, and then they you know, put some good wins together. Built a bit of form against Italy and a good win against Scotland, and then played
great, great win. The last win is great. It's great for Ireland, their confidence, isn't it? And it's great for where they're going, and great for the coach, and you know.
Yeah, look, it's again, I like the way Irish rugby is operating. I think they've got an unbelievable underage system that's bringing really good young players through, and it's exciting. There are good guys coming through, and I was pleased for Ireland. I thought Ireland were, you know, were the far better side on the weekend. I thought England were disappointing, and I couldn't put my finger on it why, because I was expecting more fireworks than
Eddie.
Well, Eddie Jones. On the back of the way they played against France in the second half when they were chasing the game,
was
you know what everyone hoped that England would play like. But the way he's setting England up is the way to win international rugby.
So yes, I accept that. But
the balance of going out there to entertain and the balance of going out there to win, like if Eddie Jones went out there and had you know, amazing, entertaining 50-point score lines and they lost 60-50.
Yeah, we crucify him. We were crucifying. Yeah, but I sort of sensed earlier you've got a beef about the breakdown. It's
the breakdown is the big, like, it's my biggest frustration, and it has been for a long time. Well, look, the law says you have to maintain your body weight in order to pick the ball up, and they've changed the ball. And every breakdown I see, I'd love to be playing, I'd love to run to a breakdown and go, ref, if that guy can stand up from that position, that's a miracle. I wouldn't even hit him because people, defensive players brace themselves expecting to get hit in order to pop themselves back up and they'll put their hands on the ball. And I just see hands pass. And the reality of the breakdown is now, it's if you're coaching, it's better to not have the ball. It's better to have a strong defense. So if you're coaching, the way to win is to kick the ball into the opposition half or the opposition 22 and defend, because teams that try to play are going to have to run into breakdowns. And you've seen Peter O'Mahony, you know, you make contact with a head, and if a jackling player's head is in a, you know, the area of a sort of a manhole because his head is that low beside the ball, how do you physically clean that without making contact to his head? As a director of rugby, I went to hearings and, you know, they were like, but did you make contact with the head? And if you say, no, I didn't, and they still a frame where you're slightly in contact with the head, it's double the ban. So it's obscene.
The only way you can actually clear that player out is actually to go over the top of them, roll them, because you can't actually physically ruck them without hitting their head.
But that's what I mean. So you can't, like, and you're not supposed to pull them. You're not supposed to pull them through the breakdown off their feet. So it's just, it doesn't make sense to me how you're supposed to clean out a breakdown, but then they're allowing people's heads be in that area. And they're saying, okay, well, the thing is, if people had to maintain their weight, like how low can people actually get? So if your feet are right beside someone's back, you can probably get your head down to your feet. That's, you know, athletic people. But if you have to lean 6 to 8 inches forward, you're going to fall over, or you're going to put your hands on the floor. That's just physics. That's, for me, is physics. So people who go long.
What about the law though? I always thought, like, I always find that if it's a ruck, it's a hands off the ball, right? My question is like, I noticed that there's a tackler go in, someone else goes over to get the ball, and then two or three people join it, but yet you're still allowed to compete for the ball. And is that not a ruck?
But again, the law says the first man is allowed to compete. So I get tackled. Kate, you're on your feet. You're allowed to compete. You get cleaned. The next guy shouldn't be allowed
to compete. No, exactly. I don't understand it.
And again, the referees, I saw it the other week. One of the referees went, no, you're second man. And it was a penalty. But then it goes back to the next day and it's just there's nothing. And I just think, honestly, like
that would change it. Yeah,
it will. But the most important man in any game at the minute is the referee and the TMO. Because and like the referees, you can tell by them, they're so scared of anything that goes on the screen is a disaster. Because it goes on the screen, it's like, well, he's made contact with his head, so there's going to be a card. As soon as the TMO goes, well, hold on, you have to have a look at that. There's a collision with the head there. It's and the referee's hands are tied because they're like, okay, well, to the letter of the law, yes, there's clear contact with the head.
But
my frustration is there's just so many different collisions with the head that don't get brought to attention of, and people are like, and it costs games. I watched, who did I watch? Exeter Sale a few weeks back, and Jack Yandel got red carded for very similar to the Peter Manny. He looked like he had his arm out and he went over the top, and I didn't think it was anywhere near as bad as Peter Manny's. But the referee was put on the screen. The referee went, look, you know what? That's a red card. And you know, you can't argue with that. But then 15 minutes from the end of the game, Exeter come off the top of the line out. Devoto hits it up. There's a ruck. And the hooker who missed the jump off the back of the line out runs around the corner and just runs in, shoulder down, hits Devoto in the head. And it's not even mentioned. And then he's the guy that scores the try to win the game for Sale sort of 5-7 minutes later. And it's like, if you're Rob Baxter there, that's what I don't miss. It's like,
if you were to change anything in the moment, if you were to change anything, that would be the break. Like you say, if the breakdowns become, because they made it sort of like, I think we watched the New Zealand sort of, that was when they started reffing it massively. And everyone was like, hang on a sec, the breakdown, you can't roll anymore. That it's going to be refereed really hard. And everyone was like, oh, you know, see, I notice everyone's kicking it away. And it's like, but then, like you say, that's they're actually interpreting it the wrong way about the law, aren't they? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, like, exactly. You know, they sort of said, look, we want to put the advantage on the defensive team, and we want to have those competitions. And that's not a problem. If it's clearly refereed, he has to be able to maintain his body weight, so which should bring his head a little bit higher out of the contact area, at least give a target area to enter in to make it safer. And second man can't take the ball. It's you know, and I think then that would encourage teams to actually hold on to the ball and play some phases, because right now, if you're in your own half and you're not there on time, it's a penalty to the defence. I think it's advantage defence, and it's all been refereed to advantage, given advantage to the defence.
You may have read in the papers a lot about this concussion stuff. Did you have any concussions in your time? You sound too sharp to have had any concussions like me.
Look, I think everybody back in the day had it, and it was a very different era. In relation to, you know, you could be, I'm sure you were punched and kicked quite a lot of times when you played against Peter Clawsey. So the chances are he was the one that ripped your shorts off with his studs. It was a very different era. And you know, I don't think anyone who played in the era, knowing what we know now, would have sort of signed up and gone, oh, you know, I definitely would have done it. But I've had concussions. I've had bangs on the head, and I didn't even know there were concussions. And you know, obviously, the player's safety is a huge thing. But you know, for me, I always was aware that rugby was a contact sport or a collision sport. And you know, I think it was, you know, injuries were kind of talked about when I was young, and you know, it was kind of, oh, you know, when we're older, we're going to be in, you know, we won't be perfect. And it was something rugby. I came from the amateur era where you did it because you loved it.
Of course.
And I think I still have that. So I totally get the cases that are coming forward. But from my point of view, I just, you know, the sport's been very, very good to me. I think that, you know, obviously the research needs to be done. I think the research, obviously I was involved in it at Leicester. We had a couple of incidents, you know, when I was an assistant coach that probably weren't handled well enough. You know, looking at those, it wasn't any sort of anything sinister. It was just, you know, you could actually see where the mistakes happened. I think there was an incident at Northampton where one player was actually already off having a HIA when another got a bang on the head. And then the wrong footage was sent to the doctor who was in sort of doing a HIA player one, and a player who was concussed probably stayed on the field too long. And it was something that, you know, when I took over at Leicester with the head of medical, Ed Hollis, you know, it was one of the things that I wanted to address and say, look, we're going to be the best in the world in relation to looking after players. And I think when I was there, we did that very, very well. But the research and the development and sort of, I suppose the concern is definitely needed. So I think rugby is dealing with it as well as possible.
The last question, I just obviously, I don't know whether you're, I think your favorite position ended up being fullback. So your Lions back three, just to finish off the podcast. And by the way, it's been great having you on. Love listening to you. Could talk for another hour, but your Lions, current Lions starting back three.
A very difficult question.
It's got to be Hogg at fullback. Come on, you're not going to
say. Yeah, look, I thought Stuart Hogg's performance against England was exceptional.
I thought
he was just world. I thought he was like very off, very not very often. I gush about a fullback, but he was exceptional. You know, and I think England kicked him the ball and they tried to put him under pressure, and his footwork got him out of trouble, and his kicking game was unbelievable.
Amazing
that spiral, that 75-meter spiral. I think I clapped. I just went.
Well, you would do. It's against England, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, no, it's just that skill. You know,
it's
a skill that you don't see very often. And guys like Ronan O'Gara practiced it. Mm. And just to be, particularly on the run, flat stick, to be able to just check and put that kick in was, I thought, you know, he's just a class operator. So he would definitely be there. You know, I've been really impressed by Reece Samet. Really, really impressed.
Oh, so good, isn't he?
I'd like to see him get an opportunity. I thought he's been.
He's unbelievable. Like, if someone said he had 80 caps and you didn't follow rugby and know he was only 19, 20, you'd be like, he's got 80 caps. You know, he's like a George North. I know he hasn't got the size, but he is a superstar, isn't he?
He did brilliantly. And look, you know, George North, he played most of his rugby as a 13, but you know how destructive he can be on the wing as well. So he would be up there for selection. Watson, Johnny May, class players. Keith Earls, you know, he...
Oh, what a try.
Well, look, he's pretty much a guy. No one's really talked about. Now, I'm Irish, so I'm obviously clearly biased. But he's been there. He's done it. He still manages to do everything right. Doesn't make mistakes. He's a machine. He's been on a Lions tour. No one's talked him up. He can finish tries like he did. His competition in the air...
Oh, he's like Gaelic football. He's amazing, isn't he?
You know, and that's some of those guys that have
against South Africa.
Yeah. Against South Africa, you know, you just need someone who's going to compete in the air. Yeah. And to be quite honest, he does that up there with the best of them. So I'm not going to pick the third spot, but I've mentioned enough bodies there.
Okay.
I thought Duane van der Merwe was brilliant. James
Very
Lowe.
Good.
They both give you a really different.
Yeah, I like James Lowe with that left foot. He can kick it in mind. I thought, why did they drop him? I know he missed one tackle, but bloody hell, I thought he was doing really well.
You know, he's had a good tournament. Duane van der Merwe. They both give you a different dynamic in that they're both 110 kilogram plus fast, and they physically take you on. Which, you know, if you wanted that dynamic. I suppose George North gives it to you, but they both did that pretty well. So
I think he'll be 13. So what are you doing with your life now? What's the plan, right? So what? I know you're going to enjoy being a dad. You're not going to go into another coaching role, or you're going to give it a rep. What are you going to do? Do you want to coach again?
Oh, look, to be quite honest, I'd have a look. I love the game. I love rugby. I have sort of rediscovered a love for rugby. So it's interesting, you know, when you have a little bit of time away and you're looking at it. And you know, if the right role came up, I would consider it. It'd be difficult to convince my wife, and that I think she quite enjoys having me at home, particularly with three young kids. She's got some help. But you know, my quality of life has definitely improved away from it. Now, in saying that, I've got to go out and get some jobs. So, you know, it's fascinating what comes out and what's out there. And I've had some brilliant meetings and some
great
beginning, you know, to get some opportunities developing. And it's I suppose it's humbling, really, when you're involved in the rugby bubble. It's, you know, head down and it's just the grind.
Yeah.
You're at it, and it's a lifestyle. It's not a job. It's 24/7, and you love it, and you're there at, you know, 6 a.m. until 8 p.m, and then you might have more work to do, and you know, you're constantly thinking about it, constantly stressing. So it's nice to come away from that and actually just go, wow, you know, I'm a better human being. I'm a better dad. I'm a better husband.
Yeah, great.
So I kind of want to keep an element of that in there as well. It's like the people come out of the woodwork. Friends of yours, of mine, that you know, you kind of just think, wow. And people are bending over backwards to try and help and, you know, give advice. Rugby's why it's an unbelievable sport. Like, you know, I think it's a unique sport in that it's as close to battle you can get without actually having to shoot bullets. You know, I think, you know, your jobs, your roles depend so closely on your friends and your teammates that, you know, you make lifelong friendships. And when you're in times of trouble, those guys all come back to help you out. So,
of course they do.
Well, listen,
great having you on. Love talking to you. I could go on forever. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it. Good luck with the little one. Hope to see you back in work on the side of a pitch, pulling your hair out and getting sort of catching up with me.
Hey, geez, Casey, we should get the goo. We should get on the old goody.
Exactly. I've already had that done. It didn't work.
You're kidding me. It didn't work.
It didn't work. It did for a bit, but then it all fell out again. Don't do it.
Was it sore?
It was actually. It's really sore. Don't be doing it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. My wife would be overly pleased if I told her I'm going to spend some money on getting some new hair.
Oh, she'll just say, I just want another kitchen, new kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. She said, just shave your shoulders and get some Pritt stick and drink it on. I've got enough on my shoulders.
Oh, I know. Listen, great having you on. Really appreciate your time. Good luck with everything. Look forward to seeing you on the side of the pitch. Cheers, mate.
Good luck. Take care.
Bye.
Kieran Bracken, Rocket.
Rocket will be back in a few weeks. Thanks for listening. Join the Six Nations and see you soon.